Next case is State of Minnesota versus Troy Lewis. Court files A160774 and A181846. Council is aware that you each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And please identify yourselves for us as you begin your arguments. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Dan Guerrero, and I'm here today representing Troy Lewis. This is an appeal from a denial of post-conviction relief following a hearing on the issue of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. There's also a sentencing issue having to do with the reliability of information used to for certain out-of-state convictions used to calculate Mr. Lewis's criminal history score. But I'd like to focus, majority, if not all, of my argument on the ineffective assistance claim. And I think it's important to know what happened here. Mr. Lewis was arrested on June 15, 2015, and then charged with two counts of false imprisonment, one count of second-degree assault, and a Danko violation. The complaint describes a multi-day incident picking up from the alleged victim's statement that Mr. Lewis had come to her place of employment 2 days earlier on June 13th, forced her into her car, and then held her and her son against their will at his house in St. Paul until she escaped and then was recaptured that afternoon on Monday, June 15th. She told a second officer, actually, that she had been held since Friday, June 12th. And she also claimed that she had no way to call for help during this weekend because Mr. Lewis had taken or broken her phone. Trial counsel, substituting for the PD's office, assumed representation approximately 2 months later. He reviewed all the reports. He familiarized himself with the allegations, met with Mr. Lewis at the jail. Mr. Lewis told Mr. Martin that the alleged victim, Ms. Jones, was lying, and he could prove it. She had been with Mr. Lewis all weekend, but certainly not against her will, and she had a phone. Mr. Lewis filled Mr. Martin in on where he had been that weekend, with whom he had been. Mr. Martin hired an investigator to corroborate what Mr. Lewis told him. There was a Casetta's manager who confirmed that Ms. Jones and Mr. Lewis were together there on June 12th or 13th, she didn't appear upset or in any distress. There was also a surveillance video from Abbott Hospital showing them there together on the afternoon of June 12th, just as Mr. Lewis had described. The investigator got statements from another individual who Mr. Lewis was with on the afternoon of June 13th, and from, importantly, Ms. Jones' grandmother, confirming they were together and had dropped off her son just that night, Saturday night, just as he had described. In early to mid-September, Mr. Lewis' sister called Mr. Martin, told her that she had a phone that she believed Ms. Jones was using that weekend. Mr. Martin was pleased to get that information, told her to send the phone to him as soon as possible, which she did. He turned that phone over immediately to his investigator, who inspected the phone and, sure enough, observed and photographed screenshots of texts between Ms. Jones and her grandmother from that weekend, proving that she had access to a phone. And he turned this report into Mr. Martin.
Mr. Guerrero, I agree. I, you know, speaking for myself and not the panel, I'm at a loss as to why trial counsel didn't pursue all that. Obviously, it had something to do with the discovery violation, but, you know, you're not supposed to have discovery violations. But, you know, I thought the district court sort of focused counsel on, okay, let's look at the sort of the, you know, we've got the victim, alleged victim with her story, the defendant with her story. Now let's focus on the independent witnesses who were kind of there on the day in question on June 15th. And, you know, they seemed to testify credibly that you know, she was kind of shoved into the car, and so why wouldn't that sort of overcome at least one of the prongs dealing with an effective assistance of counsel, i.e. wouldn't have made a big difference?
Well, I would suggest, first of all, that the agreement in itself to limit that evidence to one day was not reasonable. And if you look
and let's say I agree with you. You know what? Maybe there was some concern about relevancy issues or getting, you know, everybody's dirty laundry. I don't know. Sometimes I see these stipulations and everyone kind of wants to keep a lot of stuff out. But getting to sort of the June 15th incident and those independent witnesses, they seem to be pretty, make a strong case, you know, that there was sort of the shoving her into the car and moving onward.
Well, I think you also have to take that into effect, into account that that the alleged victim wasn't allowed to be impeached mm-hmm. by her earlier statements mm-hmm. to police and at trial when she testified that she didn't have a phone. The jury's going to know that, and then they're going to have to weigh that as to what she said happened and against these independent witnesses. And I would suggest if you read the transcript closely, these independent witnesses were not all that...
Independent or credible or both?
Credible. They observed them, one observed
and
them walking.
And who makes that determination? The jury, right?
The jury would make that determination, but they were without information that would allow them to make credibility determinations with respect to the alleged victim.
But the verdicts would suggest that the jury didn't give a whole lot of credence to what the alleged victim said because they acquitted Mr. Lewis of the second-degree assault charge, which was pretty much dependent on her testimony. So the verdict would suggest that the jury did find these independent witnesses to be credible. So, you know, assuming there were performance issues on the Strickland test, how did that, what difference would it have made in the jury's determination that these independent witnesses were credible?
Well, I think one of the things is that Mr. Lewis didn't testify and he was discouraged from testifying by counsel. And he was discouraged by the fact that he had none of that witnesses or that phone evidence to back him up as to what he was going to say. I think the post-conviction court made a point to suggest that there would have been no point for him to testify because he had nothing to prove anything different on the day in question, June 15th. That wasn't she mischaracterized his testimony there. He didn't testify that he didn't testify because at the hearing he didn't testify, that he didn't testify at trial because he didn't have any evidence backing him up on June 15th. He meant the whole 3-day period.
But what difference would his testimony have made vis-a-vis the testimony of the witnesses who saw the victim being thrown into the car, that screaming, bloody murder? I mean, how would any testimony of his have changed their observations and the jury's determination that the facts that they testified to from their observation met the elements of the kidnapping offense?
Well, I would suggest that those witnesses did not see what the court is describing as throwing into the car. She heard one of them heard arguing, but was not close enough to hear what they were saying. She described them as females. She described the little boy as a girl. The other
weren't
one,
those arguments that were able to be made at the trial, regardless of whether your client testified or not?
They should have been. Some of them. May have been. I can't remember his closing argument. I know it was not effective, obviously. Yeah, he waived his opening statement and then rested without calling a single witness. But you have to understand, without all that other evidence, just assume that the jury heard what I was describing to you in the beginning of this case. There was no opening statement. There was no story as to what actually happened that Mr. Martin could not provide to this jury. That limited his ability from the get-go to really develop any type of theory of defense. As I suggested in my reply brief, it's understandable, especially absent evidence to impeach Ms. Jones or evidence to rebut her testimony, the two strangers, seeing what they saw, would have assumed the worst. But Mr. Lewis had an explanation for that, that she had She had asthma, that she was either fainting or actually having an attack, and he went out and picked her up and put her in the car. The one fact about this also is this other neighbor who testified that she observed Ms. Joan drive the car back herself. Now, that wouldn't have happened if this was an actual kidnapping. And it matches Mr. Jones' testimony, Mr. Lewis's testimony, that he actually had dropped, he had actually gotten out of the car, gotten into his other car, and let her drive back to the house.
But didn't the jury also hear Mr. Lewis, hear testimony that Mr. Lewis told the police shortly thereafter that he hadn't seen the alleged victim that whole day, and in fact hadn't seen her for a long time until she showed up at his house that day? So didn't the jury also have that information?
They did, and Mr. Lewis disputed that. And as the court knows, the interview in this case was not recorded, so his statements verbatim were not introduced at trial. They came in through the officer who testified based on her recollection of the conversation as to what Mr. Lewis told her. At the post-conviction hearing, he denied saying that to the officer. He said that he told the officer specifically what happened, and the officer was more focused on whether he was beating her and assaulting her.
I have serious problems with the performance prong. I think that what happened here was troublesome to me. I'm more concentrated, and I'm quite frankly also very troubled by this off-the-record conference on the state's motion, where we have no ability to really do any effective appellate review of what the arguments were, what was going through Mr. Martin's mind and coming to this stipulated agreement. All of that's very troublesome from the standpoint, I think, as to whether his performance was proficient or not. I don't think you have to talk much more about performance, at least to convince me that it was lacking here.
Or me.
But the prejudice part is really the more crucial issue, and prejudice both in terms of what this additional evidence would have done to change maybe the context or the ultimate outcome. Because I mean, the issue on performance or on prejudice isn't just whether he would have been acquitted of everything or not. It's whether maybe he wouldn't have been convicted of kidnapping, which requires an intent to terrorize. So, I mean, in the little bit of time you have left, after I've rambled here for a minute, I apologize for that. I really hope you'd talk to me about your best points on what it was about the performance that prejudiced your client in the outcome of this case, why it might have been different.
I just think you have to understand and focus on the whole idea of giving up on that exculpatory evidence and his inability to tell a story, his inability to say exactly what happened, which may have affected the jury's view on Ms. Jones herself, whether she screamed because she just was making that up, like she made up all of her other stuff earlier that weekend. And also the fact that Mr. Lewis himself would have provided testimony that frankly matches a lot of what some of those independent witnesses say. They were walking down the street nonchalantly, tossing a football. That's what Mr. Lewis said. They were arguing. That's what Mr. Lewis said. The only damaging evidence is these witnesses saying that he took her from the street and threw her in the car. And I don't know that they actually said that. And as you see,
one of them blurted out, I think he's kidnapping that woman. Isn't that
no? Did you witness an abduction? I did not know. We didn't know what was going on. Mm-hmm. She said that. I mean, that is an argument somebody could, evidence somebody could have used effectively in closing about this kidnapping conviction. And I, you know, it gives me no pleasure to attack the performance of another defense lawyer. It's hard work. But this case really struck me when I heard Mr. Lewis's story, and I delved into it, and I uncovered all of these facts of what he agreed to limit, and I think it did prejudice him, and I would disagree with the post-conviction court's conclusion here. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Guerrero. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. I'd like to talk about both Strickland prongs, but based on the discussion that was just had, I'd like to begin with the prejudice prong.
Well, there's someone who can read a panel.
So before you get into it, let me just tell you what I'm thinking about, Mr. Petras, and maybe your arguments can address it. The jury, apparently the stipulation was, okay, we'll talk about June 15th, but the state can also put in some evidence on relationship, which is fine. The law allows it, probably would have been expected in this case. I read the transcript, and it was pretty nasty relationship evidence. So the context in which they viewed what happened on June 15th was the independent witnesses, what KJ said without being impeached, and the relationship evidence that showed that he had choked her, stomped her, repeatedly beat her over the course of this relationship. So that's the context that the jury heard this evidence presented without knowing the fact that there was evidence that these two had been together voluntarily the whole weekend leading up to that day, or at least there would have been evidence to that effect. So it's that context that I'm troubled by in terms of whether or not the outcome of this trial might have been different had the jury heard that impeachment evidence.
Well, I'd like to respond, Judge Flory, by saying that Judge Ospie, in her detailed 58-page decision, assumed that every piece of evidence that appellant and Mr. Guerrero now claim should have been introduced was introduced. And was there to provide that context in the days leading up. I don't think consensually, under a certain perspective, being together on a Friday, you know, somehow negates the fact that someone was confined against their will 3 days later under different circumstances. And the independent witnesses, I think, are crucial here. We have a 9-year-old son of the victim and those three lay witnesses, and all the facts they testified to were not going to be impeached by anything that happened on June 12th, on June 13th, and June 14th. They weren't asked about anything that happened on June 12th, June 13th, and June 14th.
Yeah, but if, and I'm troubled by the fact that the victim could be so clearly impeached by a number of statements she made about what happened in those prior days. And I am concerned about context and how it could possibly have been a fair trial. I mean, I will join in with the rest and say this case stands out to me as one in which there really is a significant concern about the effectiveness of counsel on some very serious criminal charges. And I'm also concerned that we didn't have the trial judge handling the post-conviction motion, which I know is not in your wheelhouse, but I mean, that also raised in my mind, how do we know? How can we tell from the record that the deficient performance didn't affect the fairness of this trial?
I disagree that the performance was deficient, and I would like to get to that. But to respond directly to what I'm understanding your question to be, I'd like to direct this court to the testimony of the 9-year-old son. And if we want to talk about specific testimony...
Is that BSS?
It is CJ.
CJ, I'm sorry.
Pages 10 to 33 of the transcript on the December 1st, which is the second day of the trial. It's 23 pages, and it is okay. Compelling, especially in the context of what the 5 counts were and the split verdicts that resulted from them. We had 5 counts: the Danko violation, kidnapping, the assault in the second degree, false imprisonment with respect to the son, and false imprisonment with respect to the victim, the mom. The 9-year-old's testimony perfectly mirrors how the jury found here. He explicitly testified that in the context of that relationship evidence, he did see the appellant hit the victim in the face with a closed fist. And then specifically about June 15th, they were trying to get away from the appellant because that had what had been happening that day. While they were outside the house, the 9-year-old testifies that appellant drove up, picked up his mom, and threw her into the car. He said, he testified that his mom told him no, she did not want to get into the car, him being appellant, but appellant responded to that by punching her in the face.
Mr. Pitches, does the record indicate that CJ was cross-examined by defense counsel?
He was.
Okay, and it was like, and you love your mom, don't you? Stuff like that.
I mean, you're free to review it. I think that may have been either included in the cross-examination or in the closing argument, which would have been the only way to address the specific testimony. Because also, he testified that once appellant had thrown the victim into the car, the appellant punched her in the side of the face. Now, what's critical is that he also testified about other facts, specifically that he got into the car when his mom told him to. That explains why the jury acquitted on the false imprisonment charge with respect to the son. He wasn't being confined against his will. He was listening to his mom. And the son also testified that he did not see any weapons under specific questioning from the trial prosecutor, which again conflicts, as was pointed out earlier, with the testimony of the victim about a weapon that was used in the car against her, and explains why the jury acquitted on the second-degree assault, which would have required a dangerous weapon charge. The son's testimony perfectly mirrors the outcome, the split verdicts in this case, and there was nothing in any of the evidence that would have provided context to that relationship that would have impeached that. The one thing that has been suggested is appellant's testimony himself. But it is beyond dispute that defense attorneys is not ineffective for advising a client not to testify when there's a reason not to. And there are several reasons not to, in this case, as I pointed out in my brief. And that one Florida Court of Appeals case that's cited in the reply brief by appellant, there was no personal waiver of the right to testify in that case. There's a detailed personal waiver of the right to testify on pages 251 to 257 of, again, that December 1st transcript.
Well, isn't part of the defendant's decision not to testify here driven by the fact that testimony that would have corroborated his version of what had been happening over this weekend was excluded by virtue of the stipulation?
It was, I guess, not presented, but he could have talked about what had happened on the 12th, the 13th, and 14th. Ultimately, it was his decision not to testify.
But again, I mean, he wasn't able to provide the corroboration that was out there, right? Through the private investigator, through the text messages. I mean, there was evidence that would have enhanced the credibility of his testimony at some of those points, wasn't there?
Potentially, but if we want to get to a reason that has not been touched on so far, and I haven't heard a response from appellant about, there was a strategic reason for going to trial when they did, and as a result, not having the text messages and the report from the investigator that Judge Bjorkman just referenced not included, is that Mr. Martin, Jeffrey Martin is the name of the trial counsel here. He's the one that testified in detail at the post-conviction evidentiary hearing. He had a strategy, and that was he wanted to go to trial that week. He wanted to go to trial on November 30th, 2015, because he had a good faith basis that the victim and her son were not going to show up. They had failed to appear.
He wanted to go to trial, didn't he? Also, until the day of trial, when he realized because of his discovery violations, he wasn't going to get any of his evidence in. I know what he testified to. I've read the transcripts. But it seems to me, quite frankly, his testimony in that regard is a little disingenuous, in that when he showed up for trial that day, he was going to present his impeachment evidence until he realized, boy, maybe I should have disclosed this evidence I had since the middle of September.
I mean, with all due respect, Judge Flory, there's no finding that he disclosed it late. In fact, there's specific factual findings from Judge Ospie when she was evaluating the testimony that you're citing that Mr. Martin was credible when he said that he disclosed the cell phone-related information as soon as he got it, and I quote that extensively in my brief. There is a dispute between when that cell phone information was available between the investigator and Mr. Martin.
That would seem to be contrary to what your associate in your office argued on the day of trial, though, Mr. Petras, that she hadn't got any of this information. Was she being disingenuous with the trial court when she said, I didn't get this mid-September information?
She was not being disingenuous. She had not gotten it mid-September. The issue isn't when the trial prosecutor got it. The issue is when Mr. Martin had it available to him. The cell phones...
Well, he knew about the cell phone, but they just were in the hands of the investigator who was trying to get the information off of them and get the text printed out. I mean, that's where they were. I mean,
all of the information that could have actually been used at a trial as opposed to a physical piece of hardware that could have been waived was not yet available under Judge Ospie's factual findings until the week before trial.
True, but also, as I understand the record, the trial counsel never advised the prosecutor, hey, we just learned there were these phones and now I'm sending them out to be evaluated.
I believe at the pretrial hearing in late September there was discussion of phones, and that is why one of the reasons that there was a continuance of the trial date from September until November, because they had just been arrived and had been referred to the investigator. So I believe that is in the record. And it's late
then
September.
Why is there a disclosure problem? Why was there a motion to exclude if, in fact, the information available was provided in September?
I think if the trial prosecutor wanted to go to trial the week of November 30th, she wanted, I mean, either to have more time to actually review independently by using the BCA or a different law enforcement agency the records from the phone, not necessarily trusting what the private investigator had provided, or... and that would have required more time. Or since she was only being presented that information right now, she would not have had time to consider it and how it impacted the case. And I want to return briefly to prejudice because there are a few corrections, and I know I'm running out of time, that I want to make on some things that Mr. Guerrero said in his reply brief. If we're talking about the one of the two witnesses that saw the abduction happen, I believe her initials were CB. And if you look at the reply brief, there's a couple quotes there, specifically on page 3. In the middle paragraph, Mr. Guerrero is quoting CB and saying that she wrote, when asked about an actual abduction, she responded, I did not know. I encourage you to go look at page 200, which he cites, of the transcript, because what she said is, and then at that time, that's when you witnessed what you thought was an abduction? Yes, is her response. And then Mr. Martin tries to continue and says, you didn't know? And she says, I did not know. So I don't think that's a complete accurate recitation of her testimony at that point. And then the other one that's quoted on page 193 is actually on page 195. And if you read that in its entirety as well, she writes, in terms of when she says, we didn't know what was going on, that's in the context of a statement, he was driving too fast, we couldn't keep up to him, and we didn't know what was going on, and I just said, if you can't get the plate, don't try it, you know. We didn't know if he had a gun or anything. They thought this was an abduction from the get-go. Very, very clearly. And again, the jury believed that testimony as reflected by the verdicts. They did not believe the victim. You can discount the victim's testimony in this case, as Judge Ospie did, and still find ample evidence to explain the convictions on the three counts that were returned. The last thing I want to address, and I realize we've only spoken about the first issue, if you will, I guess there are two ineffective assistance issues. I'm not planning on discussing the acquiescence to the concession to the Danko or to the criminal history score issue unless there are questions from the panel.
Unless you can explain a definition for what implied acquiescence is, I don't think we need to get into that.
I'm not sure if I'd be any better qualified than the Minnesota Supreme Court was in Luby, so I'll point you there, Judge Flory.
Thank you.
But I do want to return to this idea of a strategy being getting to trial quickly. It's a legitimate strategy to try a case, as you all know from your experience serving on the trial court, to get a trial undergoing when you have a reason to believe that the victim is not going to be participating, and in particular her son, who ultimately provided such compelling testimony. And Mr. Martin was...
I also know, as an experienced lawyer, that the state will be able to, if that witness truly is unavailable, the state may likely get the information in through the reports made to police, which were very damning.
I don't know of the... I think everything there was testimonial. And I'm not sure if the... I don't believe any 911 call from the victim that day. So I am actually not sure of how the statements that are cited in police reports as belonging to the victim would have come under substantively in any possible way.
So there would have been some police officer testimony and then these independent witnesses.
And the police officer testimony would have been limited to not talking about what the victim told them, because under the confrontation clause, it would not have been admissible.
So it gets back to the independent witnesses, which you think are the, which you assert are the really the keys.
I see that point, and I think that Judge Ospie's and my evaluation of the strength of that evidence is in retrospect, now knowing. It's always easy to see, you know, what's going to be strong after a trial takes place. Obviously, Mr. Martin was not presented with the opportunity of knowing exactly how every witness would testify beforehand. I see my time is up. May I finish answering your question?
You may.
But, I mean, looking at the facts as he knew them at that time, he had reason to believe that the victim was not going to testify. And if the victim did not testify, surely her 9-year-old son was not going to be brought to court by someone else. And the state's position is that that testimony from the 9-year-old that I was describing in detail before is the most powerful of the independent witnesses, and that's what explains the verdicts.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you for the time.
You have 5 minutes of rebuttal, Mr. Guerrero.
Thank you. There wasn't cross-examination. There was not very effective cross-examination of Colio, the son. He spent the majority of the cross-examination repeating what he had said on direct. And the young boy couldn't say where they drove or if they drove anywhere at all after the incident, how they got back to the house, what happened when they got back, indicated they were hiding in the basement, would be consistent with Mr. Lewis's testimony that that the two of them were essentially in cahoots about this OFP, that there was a constant and continuing togetherness by the two of them. And it wasn't simply that they were together over the weekend. It's that she lied about it. And so the fact that they were there voluntarily together is not necessarily what's important here. It's that she lied about it. His statements about her mother being punched in the face, there was no physical evidence whatsoever introduced at this trial that the mother suffered any physical injuries at all. So his testimony doesn't necessarily match the physical evidence here. With respect to Mr. Lewis's, with respect to Mr. Martin's so-called trial strategy, hoping that witnesses don't show up, I've never tried a case on that basis. I don't know any good lawyer who would simply hope that a witness doesn't show up in that way and therefore give up all the evidence that I could have presented so in the hopes that somebody wouldn't show up. And Judge Bjorkman is right. Not only could some of the statements conceivably come in without her, but the state certainly has the power to go get a witness as well if they don't show up. There was no reason for Mr. Lewis not to testify, but for his lawyer's advice not to testify. Judge Frisch ruled that he could be impeached by a felony, and that's it. And some of the evidence that they claim they were protecting him against, such as this burglary from January of 2015 involving the grandmother, that came in unobjected to anyway. So there was no reason for him not to testify. And he would not have been able, given the stipulation, Mr. Lewis would not have been able to testify about what happened on June 13th, 14th, 12th, 13th, or 14th. If he tried, there would have been an objection, and it wouldn't have come in. Mr. Martin had these phones. He knew about them in September. I'd implore you to read the memo that Ms. Kugler submitted. It lays out the timelines and the facts quite accurately about what happened here. He knew what was on those phones. He could have simply had a conversation with her at the October 6th pretrial. Hey, I got these phones. I think that we might want to take a look at them. I mean, he didn't even mention it to her. There, you can also consider the testimony, and I apologize, Judge Flory, for probably not being able to convince you specifically of points, but I'd ask you to look at Mr. Bass's testimony at the hearing. I think he presents.
Which point? I'm not sure which one. You haven't.
Mr. Bass is the.
I know who he is. Yeah. But you apologize for not being able to convince me on something. I'm not quite sure what you're referring to.
In terms of why he was prejudiced, why Mr. Lewis was prejudiced. Even without this evidence, Mr. Bass does testify as.
Well, I don't think anybody should read anything into my questions in terms of how I've decided or whether I've decided the matter.
So. Well, I just think that the jury, but for his deficient performance, the jury would have heard from witnesses that they were with that weekend. They would have heard from the Casetas manager. They would have heard from the defense investigator and seen highly relevant exculpatory screenshots of text messages and transcripts of voicemail messages, all contradicting her statements to the police and her testimony at trial. I would hope that this court would have some reservations that Mr. Martin's performance undermined the confidence in the outcome of this trial. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Guerrero, and thanks, counsel. We had somewhat of a spirited discussion. It helped us understand the issues. We appreciate your preparation, and we'll have a decision for you on the matter within 90 days.
Thank you. It was nice to see you again, Mr. Guerrero.
Thank you. All right. Last matter for oral argument today is State of Minnesota versus, I'm going to just say anytime bail bonds, since that's the issue that's before us. The state did not file a